Okay, so we're ready to start. We'll be talking a lot about natural resources today, but our own most limited resource today actually is time. So good to go. The title of our panel is Let Nature Rule. We had a heated debate whether to put a question mark behind it, but decided against it to make it more provocative. And we will try to provoke your questions and debate, and we'll have open the floor for that like in the middle of the session, so don't worry. The subtitle of the panel is Exploring Solutions and Impacts of Audiovisual Environmental Decision Systems, which we will have a very specific case of to debate. And it's generally about the desirability and also the feasibility of governance, of certain governance solutions and their implications. So this space is co-convened by the Institute for Advanced Sustainability Studies, an institution in Potsdam, here close here to Berlin, and we have Kerstin Fritsche with us. She is a senior researcher at the Institute dealing with digitalization and sustainability, and in particular she is collaborating on a project with the European Union, which is, I have to look it up, European Automated Environmental Governance Initiative. We'll talk about this in a minute. Second, but very important guest is Dr. Thomas Müller. Very honored to have you with us. You are one of the eminent cognitive psychologists dealing with artificial intelligence, very renowned for your approach on human-machine mediation called HUM, which you have established a center about, but you will have the opportunity to introduce this in a minute. And last not least, there is Kai Andreas Ingolfsson. Kai Andreas is a systems engineer. He's the CTO for Earth Intelligence Systems, a company for which you have developed the software Gaia AI. I am pronouncing this right.
Gaia AI.
Yes, maybe we start with you, Kai. You are currently developing a new platform for environmental governance at the initiative of the European Union. Maybe you can describe what this is about.
Yes, exactly. So the European Union's project that we just learned about before has decided to license our technology for a new pilot project close by Berlin in southern Brandenburg. And our technology, Gaia AI, is essentially an automated environmental governance decision system that allows you to base your decisions about sustainability and your business action and your day-to-day life action and decisions on a mix of machine learning, big data, and remote sensing, as well as a lot of ecosystem sensory that is attached to wildlife, plants, and other kind of natural environments that allow us to teach the machine learning algorithm with the right context.
Yeah, you worked with an early version of that software some years ago in Costa Rica. That's where we met. I forgot to introduce myself, by the way. My name is Alberto Jimenez. I'm from Costa Rica, a journalist, but work and live mainly in Honduras, where I work for several regional media. You can look this up at the conference website more in detail, and also for the New York Times, by the way. When you say, Kai, that you work on with the sensory data, you focus on the water, energy, food nexus, right?
Yes, this is right. The water, energy, food nexus provides a great playground for a decision framework, so to say. So as a first kind of instruction and guidance protocol that you can obstruct onto the machine learning algorithm, you need that in the beginning, so you need some sort of framework and concept in order to get the process of nature becoming itself through the machine learning tool to get that kick-started. And this is just what we're doing. I can get into this a bit later as well. I don't want to take much time from the other panelists.
Okay. Kerstin, as someone addressing the issue of governance from the perspective of policymaking for a long time, can you please explain how do you exactly envision the implementation of automated environmental governance, especially in the context of the European Union?
Yes, thank you very much. Well, it's basically based on what Kai just explained. There's a rising consensus actually within the European Union, European countries, that we've overstrained our environment with the industrial and societal system that we are living in. So now the new approach is actually to find ways for environmental governments which use tools which are available to us today and to link them with the environmental governance systems which are already in place. And there was a group of, let's call it like-minded European countries which came together and which took the initiative to try out AI-based automated environmental governance systems to better manage the world water, food, energy nexus within the EU, because there is definitely the consent that there is a new approach needed, because environmental governance as it used to happen before.
Just a few words maybe on what the water, energy, food nexus is. For those who don't know, it's a governance approach that has been put forward since the, I would say, Bonn conference in 2011. And it's about making land use more efficient, both in terms to make agriculture and electricity production, water use, etc., compatible across sectors and scales. So this is where you apply your platform and your approach. But maybe we come back on this in a minute. But for the moment, I would like to ask Thomas Müller. You have a well-established practice of managing disorders linked to human-machine miscomprehensions above all. Maybe you could explain what this is about and how it applies to the topics we're discussing.
Yes, also for me, thank you very much for inviting me here. I think I have a very interesting point to add to your perspective there. I hope so, at least, because I think it's an important, of course, I think it's an important position to take. So when we are talking about the digital world, what we are tend to forget is that not everybody can actually take part in the digital world. I mean, we have things like cognitive divide or digital divide that is making global solutions impossible. At the same time, we have this in the current programmer's paradigm is that we create one-size-fits-all solutions, which obviously they do not work for different cultures. We have to think cultures, we have to think individuality here and also the necessity of human individuals. So what we also see, especially here in Germany, is a technology gap, for example. We have people with disabilities who cannot participate, who cannot use technologies. We have people living in remote places who cannot use technologies. We have young people that use technologies without knowing the consequences, and so on and so on and so on. So what we do at the HUM, at the Human Machine Mediation Center, is we are trying to explore or communicate between humans and machines. So what we are doing is we are helping humans to better understand machines by educating them about them, basically also by supporting them through this appropriation process of technology. But on the other hand, also we are helping machines to better understand humans by, for example, creating the right environment, by making sure that the input is also creating the output that is intended by the project. We had one project, for example, that makes it more feasible is we had a project we were guiding the onboarding process of an artificial intelligence in a company, which took several months. And usually you think, okay, bringing a new technology into a culture is only a thing of a day or a week maybe, but no, it's not. And this is often forgotten because culture is very fluid. And well, what I try to do here is to bring in the culture into account as well, because it's often just not regarded.
We're talking now about humans and machines. Let's come back for a minute to the systems that sustain them both, natural systems and especially water, energy, food nexus. We have several multiple crises coming up in different places of the world. Even here in Berlin, we have currently a water crisis coming up, which is not very much talked about in the media, but still it's there, a long drought. We have important energy crisis in other places. Kerstin, how do you envision to help these systems with these kinds of multiple crises?
Yeah, well, it's not only that we are having more crises, be it environmental or also economic, but we also know more about them. Using technologies in various of sectors, for example, the new notion of Industry 4.0 provides a huge amount of data that could be actually used to manage those kind of crises, but also manage the system before it's actually getting into a crisis mode. And the same is for social data coming, for example, from e-commerce, etc. So what we are envisioning in the Automated Environmental Governance Initiative is to also use those new trends and to make them an input for the governance systems that we already have in place, that we already see. And of course, this is very complex, so we are starting with a couple of pilots throughout the European Union. One is actually going to happen in Treuenbrietzen, which is a small community in the southwest of Brandenburg, which is energy sufficient. And there we are working together with the local community to gather their data to include them into the design of the environmental governance system, and to also see what the decisions made by the AI then kind of cause for reactions and how solutions could then be implemented. So we are here linking very modern digital technologies with, of course, with people.
Yeah. Yeah, if I may raise a question here, of course I'm not an expert on environmental governance, but from what I know, there are this project, like for example, carbon taxes, which is basically only helping the rich people because it's binding sustainability to income. So it is, again, it's excluding people here. How do you want to make sure that this approach is inclusive?
Yeah, well, this is what it's actually all about, being inclusive, not only with regard to people, but also with regard to nature, and actually giving back nature some say in what is happening to it. So the way we're actually trying to be inclusive is also not just to educate people within this project on environmental issues, environmental governance and literacy, but also on technical literacy. Because basically, if you don't understand the technology behind, you cannot trust the decision that it makes or the advices that it provides you with. So we are actually linking those two aspects very organically in the project.
Yeah. I mean, I also know about this project from you, Mr. Ingolfsson, in Costa Rica, which you mentioned earlier. And I'm a little skeptical about if it's using this approach really helps to be that inclusive. I mean, because what the outcome of your project in Costa Rica was, for example, that it only the people...
No deforestation anymore.
May I make my point, please? That only the people that were actually able to participate needed to buy a smartphone. So they need, also, again, we have this exclusiveness which is created through an income. Only if you have access to a smartphone, you can participate in the project.
Well, you need to have a smartphone, but what you kind of obscure here is the actual system that we put in place in Costa Rica, and that has been highly successful. It's been a universal basic income scheme that required people to let go of their environmental decision making, so most of their day-to-day consumption choices, for getting into a universal basic income. And it was one of the first, like Costa Rica being one of the luckiest or happiest countries in the world, it was one of their first approaches of trying to understand how they can sustain that, how they can actually go beyond just being 100% renewable energy, which is also the case already now in that country. And what you try to hint on is that not everybody in a society follows through with that approach. Like, not everybody in our testing society joined the UBI scheme and our, we called it economically, as a new term for reorganizing economy, that it doesn't create a ecologic anomaly anymore. Okay, so this is the kind of approach of how can we reunite human societies with the ecosystem, and we've proven to ourselves that humans are not able to make these decisions. Our human-based governance has not succeeded so far, and we're not having the time anymore to go with these experiments for any longer.
And just to make clear, one point to the audience, maybe for those who don't know the project, was that what Mr. Muller hinted at, that the critique on the project was that the ownership of the smartphone enabled you to opt in. And if you didn't, you couldn't, and it ended up with some poor people picking up garbage for the welfare in order for them to keep their footprint steady or to reduce it. Yeah. So there was an equity issue going on with it.
Yeah, definitely. If I might jump in, I mean, we closely regarded this project in Costa Rica, and it actually taught us a lot of lessons, and it showed in particular that we need to take the human context into account, and that those kind of technologies need to be embedded. So we learned a lot from it, and we hope we can actually improve the system that we have based on this experience and make it more inclusive in your sense.
Yes, how do you want to make sure that this inclusion actually happens? What is the governance take on that?
Well, yeah, as I said, we're linking it with a lot of programs on the ground. We're linking it with hackathons, for example, for school kids. We're really trying to make them feel comfortable with the technology, to really feel that it's part of their life, that they can trust their decisions on it. So this is part of it, but of course also the output that we're getting from the automated environmental decision system or information system is channeled back into decisions on the local level and is then discussed and integrated, and of course implementation matters, and this is actually what we are trying to bridge now, the implementation gap. I mean, in the European Union, we have about 130 different environmental targets. I mean, how do you want to govern them and really make them come real? This is such a complex system. The only answer that could be to this complex system is actually also to complement it with a system which is capable of comprehending all those different aspects.
Can I just add to this? Because as a technologist and as a CTO of my company, I was a co-founder like back in 2008, so we're about 10 years in with our approach. And what really blew my mind after 5 years, just short before the Costa Rica project, was I'm in it for sustainability, that's for sure. But I always try to figure out how can we not betray ourselves constantly in our sustainability-oriented decision making. And I personally, and also in my societal like sphere, I saw a lot of people struggling with not being able to live up to their expectations about themselves and being sustainable or not. And that was really one of the core motivations that made this approach to algorithmic-based decision-making and different sorts of choice architectures a amazing new tool that, and I can come into this a bit later maybe, allows us to actually introduce the will of nature, I would say, into our day-to-day decision-making. And it allows us to challenge ourselves against not just our current very human-biased perspective on the world, but actually on a long-term ecosystem perspective. So actually letting nature speak to us and be part of the decision process.
Sorry, I really have to strongly contradict here. And I have a feeling like talking to a cult or something. Sorry. I see many points here that are just not right. We'll start for one. The exclusion factor is still there. You cannot erase it. What you're doing is you're excluding humans by that, by taking an AI, making an AI taking decisions. You're excluding humans. You're also excluding culture from all this whole process, because you cannot expect that people that are living in such a system are actually able to understand what it means and how they can participate in it. You know, we tend to forget that, especially here in the technical university, where we are all very literate when it comes to digitality. However, this is just a very small percentage of society, a very small percentage, I can tell you. And the big part of society is basically excluded by this approach. The second thing is when you come and try to quantify nature, you are taking a mathematical approach that's based on a human construct, and you're trying to understand nature. However, what you're doing when you with the computer people come to nature and you take all your statistics and all your artificial intelligence and all your big data and all the buzzwords, what you're doing is you're not trying to understand nature, you're trying to solve nature. This is what you're doing. And this is the fundamental ideology bias that is programmed into this technicus that we're talking about, into the technology.
I would by far reject that notion of this being an ideology, because what you just tried to argue for through the back door is to reintroduce human bias and to maintain and sustain human bias instead of sustaining our actual ecosystem that allows us to sustain ourselves as a human population.
Well, coming with this extinction argument is also very kind of populist move here. At the same time, you're making up this problem, and I totally agree there is a problem and we need to face it. However, the solution you are presenting is hiding the problems that come with the solution. You're using a tool and there is an ideology inscribed in it.
Oh, about your challenge, being challenged about the inclusiveness point, I feel, Kerstin, again and again here. How is it that you want to make sure this is not ideological?
Well, I mean, it's just a fact that we are running into a climate crisis, that we are running into resource crisis, biodiversity losses in unprecedented manner. So, I mean, humans have been forcing themselves onto nature for, I don't know, 10,000 years. So it's finally actually time to kind of manage this impact that we are having on the earth. And AI could be, and we are honestly believe this, a tool to bring it back into manageable terms.
It's really like understanding this as going through human history, going from this perspective of humans being dominated by nature, switching position about 10,000 years ago in the Neolithic age to dominating nature. And the problem is our management approach to nature has been one of very destructive domination. And we have made great success in many of our governance processes. We've made success in how we structure our societies. Things that happen within our life scope and within our mental and cognitive abilities are fine. We can't, as a human, go into the future. We can't understand complex systems. We're not able to grasp that. And that's why these new technologies allow us to, for the first time ever, have a legitimate actor within our decision-making structures that can actually reflect the future necessities and needs of our ecosystem in order to be sustained and sustain ourselves. And that just goes beyond amazingness, I would say.
Excuse me, I mean, you said legitimate actor, but I felt that what was implicit in Dr. Muller's observation was that might be the danger of a dictatorship, actually, of nature, of something that is no longer truly legitimized by anybody?
By nature. By nature. So the dictatorship that you would usually describe or understand to be present is one that, essentially is put from a perspective of a few people of a very small and powerful class onto a whole society. This is not the case in Gaia AI. Gaia AI is truly there to reflect ideas and needs that are non-human.
Yeah, and if I may add to this, actually, in the European project, we are very much linking this, of course, with people and with governance and decisions, local councils, communities, so there can be no talking of some sort of a superior decision. So it's all coming also from within. I don't know if you're a techno-skepticist or so.
No, I'm not a techno-skeptic. I'm far from that. However, what you are doing is you're just collecting and reading data and trying to interpret it, and by that saying this is nature's will. This is not how it works. I'm sorry for telling you. We have to think about the ideology that's inscribed in your technology that you're proposing here, because this is the core of the problem. This is why, I'm sorry to say, this is why your project is designed to fail. It is not thinking about culture.
Just one question on how exactly are the data fed to the system? I didn't get this very clearly, and maybe it's important to understand the basis of what we're talking about.
So as I said before, there is this whole point of allowing different data streams to come together, and we call this the big connectors. This is really there because we understood that there's a lot of micro contexts that we cannot feed into the whole meta level system, and therefore it depends on which specific area in the ecosystem is advised by Gaia AI. But usually it is a combination of socially constructed data collected in the environment, so in the ecosystem and in the ecosphere, and beyond that also a lot of satellite imagery and other also open data, as well as citizen data, or what it's like, I always forget the name, but sensors provided by citizens, etc. So all of this is brought together, and the whole point is that, as we've had it in the beginning, the World Energy Food Nexus provides a first framework to categorize and organize these different data streams, so the machine learning algorithm can actually start to build its own perspective on it, over time.
Does population, I mean human population, also go into the data? Is it a factor? Because it has always been an important factor in scenario building and environmental context since the Club of Rome. So is this a factor you consider too?
Yes, I mean, we don't consider. We're building a technology that allows itself to consider itself after some time, right? So there's no we make the decision in this. But yes, population, and I usually like to insist that there's animal and other populations that are part of this. But yes, human population will be affected by this. And there's cases of relocation, for example, that happened in some of our first testing environments, because there's no other way than putting some pressure off the ecosystem.
Yeah, this is actually a good example. I mean, what you're doing here is, you say this, that this technology is thinking on its own in some way, but it's not. Maybe to emphasize on my point that I want to make, what you are doing is you are programming your vision and also the vision of the European Union into a software which you put onto a culture and on a society, and then say, okay, this is the way it should work. And then if the society doesn't work like this, as we saw in Costa Rica, you simply say, well, it was the wrong society. But this is not the approach. This is not the way the culture works. You have to admit that people are appropriating technologies differently, and you don't know how they will do it. Therefore, this your very strict top-down approach there is not going to work. And you have to think about a way how to implement culture in there, how to make it interpretable by users, for example.
I want to come back on one other keyword I heard, which kind of was upsetting, which was relocation. Are we here talking about enforced relocation, like we've seen in the Philippines, or what is it that you were aiming at with that idea?
I mean, you brought up population, but yeah,
no,
so
but I'm specifically
what happened with
relocation
the EAPS,
is
what
a
happened
measure.
With the EAPS in Philippines under Duterte is that they also had a pilot project with us about a year ago, and we agreed on that just at the starting times of Duterte's time as a president, and we organized a pilot commune where the same structures as in Costa Rica have been adapted to the local social-political system. And unfortunately, the enforcing mechanisms, so the guidance and the governance decision-making happens in Gaia AI, but the execution happens based on the local socio-political system. So what we saw in the Philippines was that there was a environmental enforcement brigade set up that essentially forced people to relocate / treat their ways differently, etc. So it was
this
a really destructive
is this really like
way
the,
of
the future you imagine for the European Union to soldiers all around this.
If I may jump in again, I mean, this
yes,
is
I think it's quite necessary.
So that you don't get the wrong impression. I mean, this is definitely not what the project is about, having environmental enforcement brigades. I mean, this was a case that we watched very closely and also got very concerned about, which shows again how much the social context actually matters in which this kind of technology is embedded. But as I said before, in Europe, we have a culture and a tradition of participation, of democracy, so this is also what is going to be built into the system, and therefore we are actually foreseeing much different implementation mechanisms, which are more based on voluntary basis than on anything like the EAPS in the Philippines. So,
okay, I feel that maybe we have some things more to discuss, but I want to miss the opportunity to just encourage the audience in case there is somebody with a red microphone, so that if you have questions or things to add, then we could just take them up. Yes, please. There is one, and here on the left as well.
Yeah, thank you. Speaking on behalf of the Energy Awareness Foundation, I think you have a blind spot embedded in your system. Isn't it consuming so much energy to monitor all these data, to monitor all this consumption? So is it
That's
really
true.
Energy efficient what you are proposing here?
Yeah, maybe we collect in the second question there on the left and then answer.
So good day, first of all, and thank you for the discussion, as you're getting right to the point really quickly and really excitedly. I think here we are in front of a question that is actually the core of the whole thing. And empirically, you can say that you need to have some laws, and so take into account of what people and communities have done before you develop a model to implement in those communities. That's kind of a discussion that I have been through in my field with science, with data scientists, when they develop a model, or not, they actually don't develop a model, but they develop an algorithm that learns by itself and adapts more quickly than what we have built with the physics or chemical empirisms or the principles that we used before. If we take that further away into a community, if we take into account, for instance, ethnography and anthropology, an anthropologist that goes and analyze the human factor and how this human knowledge adapts and how they have along these 1,000 years developed an empirical knowledge that adapts perfectly to their environment, then I think we come to this society constructed data that you were talking about, and I think that's a really thrilling question, because I do think that data science gives a tool for us to encourage the majority of the people to participate, but I also think that this socially constructed data that you just mentioned, and that's what Dr. Mueller, I think, was talking about, we have to take into account this empirismus, whether we're talking about industrial empirismus or ancient Inca empirismus, and that's hard to incorporate in this kind of models. But if we manage to do that,
we don't. It's impossible.
That's impossible. Okay.
I wouldn't agree.
Okay. Only two different paradigms.
I just wanted to point out that question. I'm shaking just because of thinking of that. It's amazing. That's the point.
There are several more questions in the audience, but let's maybe first answer this specific question about energy use, and then the others, and then there are... Okay.
Yes, I would love to answer to this maybe after this presentation. So just the energy question, we truly see energy consumption being a question in big data, in AI, in all of this, but in our case, we're not using it to get your car to move by itself. We're not using it to sell you more unnecessary stuff. We use it to help ourselves organize our systems as a society and as an economy in a way that truly allows us to be sustainable without going into complete chaos, because we're not able to handle that complexity ourselves. And just as a kind of practical note from our company, as I'm being Icelandic, or partly Icelandic, growing up in Germany, but still having closely family ties there, we early on understood that one of the best places to run such infrastructures is polar regions, right? So we're currently using a 100% renewable geothermal energy source for all of our parks. And that is, for me as a sustainability activist, it's the only way to go, for sure. But we're also aware that there is a general challenge of imposing or also introducing this new line of thinking about digital technologies and their resource consumption, etc., from a sustainability perspective. And I'm trying to, as a CDO in a tech company, trying to bring this new dimension into this very much non-sustainable field today.
Okay, on the other question, on
mm-hmm. Yeah, maybe just a quick comment. One principle that is also part of our project on EU level is actually co-learning, which means not only co-learning within the society, but also with the AI that we are using to actually get a bit away from this empiricist view, but to also integrate those different knowledges into the AI governance system which we are building to make it more human and more inclusive, to accommodate Mr. Muller's point.
You basically said it was impossible when you...
Yeah, I think it's impossible because this is a totally different paradigm. You cannot come with a set of rules and try to force this set of rules onto a culture. Nothing else is what you're doing with it, using AI. Because you have to reflect on where does the rules come from, what perspective of culture is embedded in those rules. And usually, it is, as I said, it is representing a European Union vision, for example, how the future of Europe should look like, which is not... which is not reflecting the diversity of our culture in the whole. And this is probably the risk that we are facing here, namely, culture is an evolving process, culture is always changing. And at the same time, when coming with such a system, we are not allowing those changes anymore. Even if we say it's learning what these changes will be, then the changes might even be applied because of this learning algorithm. You don't know what kind of uses or what kind of gratification approaches processes come is happening there. This is things you cannot
foresee.
That's the
whole point.
Okay.
No, it's beyond human cognition.
Let's not get bilateral again. There were additional questions there, and then in the row.
I just don't want to turn my back to the public. I'm not into AI. I feel like really a little bit puzzled, and I want to explain why. Well, I'm not into AI. I'm working on the commons. I think that the human factor is the decisive one. So I felt like I'm very much with your arguments, Mr. Müller. At the same time, there was a moment when I forgot your name, CEO, your name?
Ingolfsson.
Ingolfsson, sorry. Said at a certain point that perhaps that's very personal, kind of confessing that actually there needs to be something that needs to challenge ourselves based on our real and true and good intentions. And when you said this, I felt like challenged myself, that sometimes I feel like, okay, having something there that is not another human, which would feel like dictatorship, but something kind of smarter, which, and this was on top of the confusion, you used an argument that my friends of the Right to Earth approach use. Let's give nature a voice. Mm-hmm. So, and then there is a policymaker saying, and that was on top of that, really thinking that in Europe cannot happen what happened in the Philippines, are you really sure? So that's the question for the three of you. I'm kind of with you, but this argument is convincing. And do you really think that the European Union is a kind of self multilateral approach to mm-hmm. deal okay. with the problems.
Understood. Two more questions from that block, and then we maybe answer, because if not, it becomes too much.
Yeah, hello. Thank you for your presentation. What I was missing is really what is going on. So you had a debate about the effects of the technology, but what is actually happening on the ground? That is the part I was missing in your discussion, and for someone who is not acquainted with your technology and the effects of it, that would help to understand your discussion. And what I think after your debate is one part that, you know, you can have an informed decision and an AI, you know, where you have the technology to evaluate what would be necessary to give nature a voice in the debate. It would be helpful to have this voice and to take an informed decision, but I can't see that this technology is making a decision for me. I think it needs to inform the decision-making process, but it's not where I see that all the factors which are necessary to make a decision will be replaced.
Okay, third and last question for this round.
Yes, thank you very much. Mr. Müller, I'm really much with your skepticism on using AI on this issue, but I think your radical skepticism made this very much a discussion of black and white. And while we're discussing, I guess, politics, you were talking about culture. I think the most interesting question is what makes it better, or what makes it less bad, and not what is perfect and what is not. Because the argument from the other side was we are trying to do something that human governance failed on, and you don't have an answer on that. So my question is, when you refuse to think about AI governance, where do you put your trust? Do you have faith in human governance on that? Because I don't have, and the others don't have too, I think.
Okay. Kai, maybe you first.
We've been betrayed by that faith in human governance. So good reason to start new approaches.
Yeah, but it also, I mean,
Yes, we introduced this kind of new model because so many things with human governments went wrong, but we also see, to maybe come to your questions, that it's only humans which can change something. So we're trying to take like the best available means, and while multilateral is because we see the scope of the problems is just so huge that of course we try to implement pilots in small communities, but at some point you need to scale it up and to have a bigger system being part of this new environmental governance system. And that's why those like-minded European countries have been chosen an approach where eventually we hope in 2025 they will all be running under this integrated governance system.
Yeah, so maybe I can comment on the question of, I liked what you said, namely that it is different if I have a human above who tells me what to do, or if I have some objective entity or above that is making the rules. What we tend to forget here is that this objective entity, what we call, or what you call Gaia AI, is not a neutral thing. It is constructed, socially constructed by persons, and therefore you still have the person above. So it's a dictatorship disguised as an all-knowing AI. And from there, coming to your question, I hope I didn't make my position myself wrong here. I'm not an anti-technologist. I'm not a neo-Luddite or whatever you want to call it. I'm not against technology. On the very opposite, I'm questioning how we can integrate technology into our society without losing our culture, but so still living with technology. And like Bruno Latour says, for example, we have to embrace technology, we have to hug it, we have to start loving it. And this is my approach. And there are prototypes and there are things that we do. For example, the center is we work with deep space probes where we help people through technology to experience what smells, sounds, and what deep space smells and sounds like to get them closer to technology. It's a very immersive feeling. Everybody just recommend to feel it for themselves. But what's also going on, for example, in the field of subconscious data science is very interesting. I think we have a visual from that somewhere. It is called dream printing by a Danish artist who is working with the subconsciousness data created by people while they're sleeping and using the data generated to print things out, to create things based on their subconscious approach. And I think this is a way better approach to working with the subconsciousness of the human being instead of working with some artificial intelligence.
Okay, I'll have to keep an eye on time. Maybe you want to respond to a very specific question that was posed to you also.
Yeah, okay. I think here we actually come to the point where I don't feel like the dystopian person anymore, because what you just introduced is a system where our subconsciousness is used as a guiding tool instead of using our behavior and our collective behavior and the complex patterns that emerge from it as a way to guide our future behavior. The thing you introduce is way beyond even like being understandable as an approach. But that aside, on how it works, because that question was raised. So as I said before, we collect multiple streams of data, but maybe the best way to do it as an explanation of how it works is to break it down to the individual experience. And in the individual experience, it's very much still what we had in this Costa Rica project. It allows you to have guidance on each and every decisions you do in your day-to-day life by Gaia AI. So it requires, obviously, a very closely knit net and pattern around yourself that collects data, that still also contextualizes that data with environmental data, with the remote sensing and all of these other sources and streams, plus the models that are calculated out of that. Because what we truly look into is the state of the Earth 100 years from now, 500 years from now, and the impact of resource consumption, waste production, energy waste, energy usage on these future states of our ecosystem. And this feeds back into your actual recommendation of what to do now. And this is what our human cognition can't do for itself. This is what we need Gaia AI for, like just as a
okay,
individual
before
reference.
We get needled more on the details on the functionality of Gaia AI, maybe it's the right moment to make a certain revelation that actually none of the very specific facts and figures and also not the positions you heard today are actually true. This panel is fictional in the sense that we are other people. Kai is actually Kai, but he is Kai Wagner, and he's a sustainability scientist who works on technological and digital issues, but with very different, very different positions than the ones he uttered here. And Dr. Thomas Müller is Wenzel Mehnert, and he is a sociologist who works at the University of the Arts, UdK, right around the corner, and new narrative structures and collective imaginaries in the context of audiovisual media. Kerstin is Kerstin, and she works at the ISS, and the ISS exists, and she even has a digitalization and sustainability project there, but not quite the way she the initiative with the European Union doesn't exist. I myself work also at the ISS on a project on narratives and images of sustainability, and I was interested to have the experience of this panel and to see how it works out, but Kerstin can explain better what we intended to do with presenting this fiction to you.
Thank you all for participating in it. It must have been hard for you at some point. It was certainly for us. Why fiction? I mean, doesn't it sometimes already feels like we are living in a fiction when we are dealing with those questions about sustainability and digital technologies and how blockchain can help us to govern resources, or about autonomous flying taxis and so on? Well, doesn't it sometimes feel like those questions we're dealing with already blur reality and fiction? And this is actually something that we noticed in our research, when where we're not only trying to find empirical results on how digital transformation is already manifesting today in very, very different forms, but we always came up with those questions where we did not find simple answers. As you might have noticed in our panel discussion, it sounded a lot like black and white, but the answers to this are actually not that easy. So yesterday, in the evening panel discussion, it was mentioned that it's really hard to talk about this kind of questions, because none of them are really tangible and are palpable, and what is this all going on? So we created this fictional space to make those fictional questions or these questions tangible for us, to bring them to concrete cases, to discuss them as if they were real. Because actually, although those projects we presented to you, the questions that we were throwing back and forth and all the worries, they are actually very, very real. And that's why we've put them into the setting, to make them also feel real, because we react differently to things which are only hypothetical than if we really live through it. So we took you onto this experience to live with us for half an hour, this alternative present in which some of those technologies we might hypothetically be thinking about already became real. And of course, we not only want to share this experience with you, we also want to know from you how it felt for you to be part of this experience. That's why my colleague have just been passing out a questionnaire, which we kindly ask you to fill in for us, so we can learn as researchers also from this experience. There are boxes at all entrances. Please leave the surveys or your questionnaires there for us as a very important and really real information source. Now, what we've been presenting to you in this panel discussion wasn't just something that we made up over a beer. There was actually a process behind it. We met 2 weeks ago with a group of people who were willing to work with us on creating such a fiction. Those people came from different backgrounds, be it academia, be it policy making, be it civil society, and we were laying out the basis for this fiction. For example, for the Gaia AI, which by that time was called Mother Earth AI, which I personally really liked. And we developed this then further into this fictional panel discussion, and with certain arguments that we wanted to bring and certain questions that we wanted to present to you. And this process actually would not have been possible with two very particular persons which did not only inspire us but also guide us through the project and contributed their methodologies. And this are Cedric Flacinski and Regis Lemberte from the design collective The Normals. And please come up on front, guys. You've been in the back, but actually you've been at the core of this process. And tell us a little bit more about yourself.
So, grab a mic.
Thanks,
Kirsten.
So actually we were doing just technical assistance today. Usually we would be the one going on stage, and so we don't have much time, so to make a really long story short, we're called Normals, and we're a design fiction collective. So we all have design backgrounds, I mean, for the most part, and we apply this work as product designers on objects, services, things that will hopefully never, ever, ever happen. Or sometimes they should, but like trying to balance sort of morality-related issues on the thin line. A year ago, we started this thing called the Future Fishing Training Program, where we tried to work a bit outside of our own artsy research practice with companies, with public institutions, and to also change a bit of the format, that it's not just pure exhibition pieces and prototypes or videos that we do ourselves, but that we try and have more compelling experiences, because the whole point of the practice is to provoke debate, of course, and try to do so more and more efficiently, more and more at the core of important questions.
And so we started developing our own methodology about how to fish the future. And fishing the future, that basically means extending towards futures into the completely speculative realm, where you cannot really predict and you can only envision things, and then try to, from this space where you're much more free to imagine a lot of different things, to bring them back closer to the present and to draw the red thread between near future and far future, and to try and see how we can present that. And we've been exploring a lot of formats. We'll get to that a bit later on how to present that.
No,
because we still have another visual, please.
So
basically the idea is that is very important for us, is that to see the future as a collective imaginary. In a way, the future already exists. It's in all of our heads. There's not one future, there's a variety of futures, and we each have a different perception of what it is, but they sort of collectively exist. So we try to look at those, and how, in a way, how to name a certain future is claiming it, is claiming ownership, but also responsibility for it. And our responsibility in this case is to present them, and to present them in ways that are tangible, that are believable. And we've tried a lot of different ways to present those futures. Some of them were through speculative artifacts, and some of them were through fiction. And fiction means also being in persona, coming on stage pretending to be someone else. And this is something that we've done at a project in Mexico City, where we built a complete fiction about what relocation for ecological reasons as well.
So basically, because I'm sorry, we have to get really fast.
Yeah.
To summarize that project as another example, that was the first time that we did like on stage fiction, basically. Or
that,
like it was a fictional conference that fed this whole thing, because we had very little time in Mexico.
We presented an entire project in persona as a fiction,
and
already
so
happening.
Yeah. We're already taking too long.
But
to make it short, basically, we go there as specialists or completely fictionals, go to an evening about the future of Mexico City. I'm like a rapid disaster management architect that specializes in 3D printed building, because we're talking about a plan to move everyone outside of the lake in Mexico. And then Regis came in as a
social economist promoting a form of universal basic income through cryptocurrency that is devaluating.
And called the Mexicoin.
Called the Mexicoin. So this was our first really public fiction, in a way, and we actually met with Kirsten when I was presenting that fiction at Republica back in May. And we decided together to take it one step further by putting together a fictional panel, and this is exactly what you've seen tonight. This was our first experiment of a multi-persona fiction on stage.
And we have 5 minutes of questions, then.
Yeah, I guess
if
we
you
can
want.
Take a few questions if there's anything.
Does anyone
like want to
react to all of that live? Cool. That's very nice. Okay, what about more constructive reactions?
Yeah, if there's any questions, we've rushed through our little speech to give you 5 minutes, so go for it.
Questions, comments?
Yeah, there's a couple.
Oh, really? Are they holding hands?
So, first of all, this is really, really cool. It's really nice to actually be forced to engage emotionally as well as just thinking about it in a dispassionate way, because it gets you thinking in a way that you otherwise wouldn't if you knew it wasn't happening. My question is, beyond this piece of paper, how do you capture the feedback from us? Because I'm sure there are lots of us who have lots of things to say beyond this now.
Scribble them down on the paper, please, and then approach us after this.
Yeah, well, thank you very much. As said, this was for us also a first experience to go with fiction, but all the science that we are doing on the implications of digitalization is pretty real. And we're always looking for new forms to engage with society and different communities on it. So we're thinking about how we can follow up on this. We will look at the results. We think how we could put this into output. And it, of course, should be open and might become even platform or whatever. We will see. And you're very welcome and very invited to get in touch with us. And then we think together about how we can use this and build onto it.
I'll also add that there is a little fictional survey that you can still find online on the website of the AEG. So if you go to aegi.eu, but the whole thing's fictional, but it actually exists, you can totally fill it in and leave us some comments. You can also go to the address here, and there's a little contact form that you can use to give us a shout and tell us what you thought about this.
There was another question.
Yeah.
I just had a short constructive feedback maybe. You could think about in the future if you do panels and then in the end you reveal it's fictional, you could think about giving a 10-minute input on the actual topic of the panel and then reveal what's actually the status quo and what's happening and some of the research that you've done just for people who've come and who really don't know to understand what's fiction and what's real.
That's an interesting point actually. Well, I mean, personally, we've always worked sort of keeping this notion or people more off balance. And in a sense, I know it's a bit like misinformation in a way, but we try to leave like a couple clues throughout this thing so you know it's not a full hoax also. And I think that as soon as we reveal that, it's also a bit up to you to go and poke around.
But I really like that idea, actually. We were a little bit under time constraints. We usually wanted to have 1.5 hours also to have this discussion much more going on and get your feedback and also explain a little bit on what were our thoughts behind. One thing we think about working around this problem right now is to make a very real paper out of it, like not like only scientific paper, but an actual paper which kind of collects those governance issues around the topic that we've been introducing today, and to of course link it then with the video or whatever output will be created from this. But thank you very much. I think definitely you're right. Yeah, that would have been very good. Yeah.
Is there one last question I saw?
I think I would agree that a big bit of a background story would be nice, but of course it would also make it more probable that people uncover the fiction. And the second point was that because there was a lot of tension on the stage, the people listening to it might feel a bit uncomfortable. And,
that was on purpose.
they think it's not so well planned, or maybe there's some confusion around what's going on, which kind of project is it, never heard of it. So maybe to make it a bit more comfortable for us.
If you think there was a lot of tension here, you should have seen the rehearsal. Yeah. But yeah, I mean, the point is also to, like, in a nice way, to nudge into a strange space where you feel a bit uncomfortable and push a little bit out of the comfort zone is also important.
Thank you very much.
in the first moment, gamification comes into my mind, because we are playing the future with kind of Second Life, where the future is kind of strange perpetuation of present. And I think, I wonder if you could do a kind of gamification where you are the, not necessarily the programs, you're more the disturbance in the whole thing to get the thing going. How do we want to be governed in the future, whatever, what kind of tools are, but to play around. I'm always pretty excited about playing the future rather than playing something which is, has nothing to do with the reality.
I'm afraid we are running out of time, although we would love to keep that conversation going with you, but maybe we can then bring it to the more informal floor. Thank you all for participating in this. Thank you for your comments, your thoughts, your questions, which also inspired us again. Thanks to all my colleagues on stage, but also behind the stage, and the people participating in making this real. This was for us a really intensive experience, and well, we hope to continue with some of you. You're warmly invited to approach us, and we can see on what we're making out of it. Thanks a lot. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And please don't forget the questionnaires.